Active History is pleased to present a recording of Steve Penfold's talk, Why We Shouldn't Talk About Confederation in 2017. The talk was delivered on April 22nd, 2017, at The Other 60s, A Decade That Shaped Canada and the World, a symposium hosted by the Department of History at the University of Toronto.
So Kim Campbell famously declared that election campaigns are no time to talk about important issues. That didn't work out very well for her. We know that. We're all historians. But I'm here to argue in that same spirit that 2017 is no time to talk about Confederation. It can't be a popular argument, particularly at a conference on the 1860s. We're all pulling out old books that we half read two decades ago, hoping they're better than we remember, and sometimes discovering that they are actually better than we remember, although not often enough in my view. Professors are thickening out their Confederation lectures. I personally have three full lectures on the subject, not just one. And we've all been answering questions from aunts, uncles, and miscellaneous cousins in backyard picnics. This is like the one time they have a chance to actually ask us questions. Just about every English-Canadian history department is taking part in Canada 150 somehow, and publishers have begun to churn out Confederation collections, including global, national, and regional themes, primary sources and reflections, and on and on. I confess that there was even a point late last year where I started writing Confederation-themed show tunes. Indeed, if you get me drunk later, I'll sing the one about Galt and how he imagines he's a poet as he reads out banking regulations to the Quebec conference. Indeed, Confederation is so academically promiscuous that it sometimes appears that we are all suffering a sort of 1867 madness, which I call PCS, or Persistent Confederation Syndrome. As a self-professed Confederation enthusiast, I'm not upset about all this attention, since the mostly critical approach of these efforts has produced much interesting work and has challenged the commemorative impulse of Canada 150. And indeed, when I stand before a group of specialists and before my smarter colleagues who have spent hours pulling all this together, and then I reflect on my title, I understand that I probably sound like a jerk. In fact, my language in here is more colorful, but I edited it for public consumption. Still, I will argue that even critical histories of 1867 can reinforce the sense that Confederation is what I call an uber event, in need of particular examination. Confederation is certainly an odd event to hang so much weight on. It was, after all, a contradictory product of several conflicting forces. On the one hand, there were forces of separation, particularly the well-known conflict of Anglo-Protestants and French Catholics in the United Colony of Canada, which George Brown so desperately wanted to escape. There were also many local attachments and allegiances that needed to be negotiated in the new Dominion. On the other hand, there were many forces of integration. There were economic matters, the desire for bigger markets, for railway building, and so on. There were, as Heidi and Paula said, defense matters. And there were also, of course, John A. Macdonald's sense that his party would become a near permanent minority in any new federated Canada that did not include the Maritime Provinces. Confederation did create many of our key government institutions and did lay out the basic division of powers, although one wonders if the word basic really belongs in the same sentence as division of powers, since Section 91 and 92 of the BNA Act were not easy to understand. They made sense within the contradictory forces that produced Confederation, but they also became the subject of long and often bitter dispute. Confederation, too, was a rather limited affair in so many ways. The Dominion was small, though imperial and expansionist in its conception, and its institutions were forged in an often technical debate about jurisdiction that did not produce many grand statements of ideological intent. Even the famous peace, order, and good government, so often held up as Canada's alternative to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, is in the British North America Act a description of institutional jurisdiction, not political culture. That's great. Our motto is institutional jurisdiction. That's, we should all walk around just with jurisdiction stamped on our forehead. And of course, the most important limit, we all know, and we make the second year class recite this, that Confederation did not produce an independent nation. Let's all say that together, shall we? Confederation did not produce an independent nation. It took three internally self-governing colonies, broke them into four provinces, and remade the relationship between them, it created a dominion that remained an internally self-governing colony within the British Empire, with a federal government to undertake some common projects. And then to further deflate our enthusiasm, we can point to the complicating factors of external pressures, most notably the government's desire to save money on the defense of self-governing colonies from which it now derived few economic benefits. Indeed, surely an accurate historical logo for Canada 150 would need more analytic nuance than marketing punch, as in these efforts that I constructed in my spare time. So here is my, that is not coming out right. But anyway, it's the Canada 150 logo, and it actually says, Canada 150 years ago, some metropolitan elites created a scheme to contain cultural conflict so that it wouldn't literally derail their plans for imperial expansion and economic development. This is why they don't get historians to make up logos. Right, there you go. And then there's this one. I was approached by the Ottawa Tourist Bureau, not really, to make up an ad for its July 1st celebrations, and this is what I came up with. Join us in Ottawa this July 1st to celebrate the British Empire's declining interest in defending its far-flung colonies. Yeah, see what I mean? But of course, persistent Confederation syndrome has mostly strategic causes. Scholars have wisely used 2017 as a national teaching moment. In a country that doesn't think much about history, we jump at the chance to be relevant. And to be deadly serious for a moment, history has been politically useful as well. Efforts by First Nations and their allies to tell an alternative story of Canada 150 focus more on the overarching colonial project that is Canada than on the Confederation moment itself seem particularly important. I appreciate these 2017 projects individually, but reflecting on the totality of our efforts, I do worry that even strategic deconstruction reinforces the underlying thrust of Canada 150, and especially its focus on Confederation as a national founding moment. No matter how nuanced our interventions, in 2017, they all become a symptom of persistent Confederation syndrome. I mean, has there ever been a subject where so many university history departments have felt it necessary to organize an event or address an issue? Couldn't we construct a list of equally powerful moments in Canadian history that have not been so promiscuously recognized? The Royal Proclamation, the Treaty of Niagara, Responsible Government, the Indian Act, the Statute of Westminster, the points system, the discovery of oil at Leduc, Alberta in 1947. All of these attracted some interest, to be sure, but hardly the attention of 1867. The underlying symptomology of PCS is to treat 1867 as an uber event that transcends all the others, one in need of particular attention. While it's easy to be critical and sarcastic, it's harder to offer an alternative. Is it even possible to take seriously the process of nation building, but to sever it from 2017? What underlying processes might we consider to understand how Canada acquired the attributes of a modern nation state? How did a settler colony of dubious international value acquire the typical features of what we now call a country? I don't mean to suggest that this is a novel question, or that there aren't many different ways to approach it, some of which Heidi and Paula already identified. One way forward, and echoing some of the points that Paul and Heidi made, one way forward might to look at the work of scholars who study political territory more broadly. Charles Meyer argued some years ago that the key theme of the century from the 1860s to the 1960s was the reconfiguration of what he calls territoriality, which is a convoluted term for an important process. I'm not a big fan of itty words, so I'm just going to call it territory. But nonetheless, governments of many different forms became invested in creating national territories, bounded spaces that could become containers for sovereignty and legal power, what Meyer calls decision space, and even for citizenship and allegiance, what Meyer calls identity space. These changes made nations. And common to all these national reorganizations, Meyer argues, was an enhanced concept of territory, defined as bounded geographical space that provides a basis for material resources, political power, and common allegiance. That's his words. These developments were broadly international, though not universal. Meyer points to the United States, Japan, Italy, Canada, Mexico, and other nations, all in some way, in Meyer's words, reforged in a rapid and often violent transformation. According to Meyer, these developments came with a mix of changes: the shoring up of central authority, the building of military capacity to be mobilized as a resource for governance, developing an industrial infrastructure based on coal and iron and others. Actually, that list works pretty well for Canada with some modifications, right? There's a shoring up of central authority, although complicated by federalism. Certainly, military capacity was deployed as a mechanism of governance in 1885. The co-opting financial elites that Meyer talks about, that's maybe a little overstated, but it's true that Canadian politicians made many accommodations with central Canadian manufacturers and railway barons and so on. According to Meyer, all of these developments acted to produce two profoundly important dynamics in territory: the shoring up of national boundaries, both geographically and imaginatively, and what he calls the saturation of space inside those boundaries, which entailed administration, technology, economy, human populations, and so on. In Canada, the making of national territory expressed the double vision of Canadian colonial status: as a self-governing colony within the British Empire and as an active colonizer of North American space. The most basic act of territoriality, therefore, was simply taking possession of the land that most Canadians eventually imagined as national. This was mostly done through treaties with First Nations, though not always, as in British Columbia, and even then, obligations were mostly ignored. The land also had to be resettled and redeveloped. A vast national space had to be connected. State capacity had to be built. Examining these processes both decenters Confederation in nation-making and recenters it in other ways. It is fair to say that Confederation was important to the process of building state capacity, since it created a mechanism to contain the cultural conflicts that had paralyzed British North American politics. But in other ways, Confederation seems marginal and was neither the origin nor the cause of change. The border, as a central attribute of modern nation states, marked the edge of this project of sovereignty. In Canadian history, this is a complex question, but let me quickly make 4 points so that Heidi doesn't tackle me. First, making borders was a long and protracted process. It began in 1783 and was mostly settled by 1927, although we could say it remains ongoing if we think of the conflicts over sovereignty in the North. The borders of the Dominion were mostly inherited, drawn not by the Confederation process, but by international diplomacies that colonials didn't control. In fact, Canadians were rarely involved in the process, and when they were, they rarely got their way, the most famous being the Alaska boundary dispute that settled the boundary between Canada and Alaska, where Canada had representation but felt marginalized by British interests. Third, border making is not amenable to anniversaries. Key moments might be the Treaty of Paris in 1783, the Treaty of Ghent in 1815, the 1818 Convention, Lord Ashburton's efforts to settle outstanding issues in 1842, the Oregon Treaty of 1846, and on and on. Each was important, but too partial, incomplete, and complicated to make for very good commemoration. Fourth point. My first 3 points have only considered the border with the United States. In fact, in the 1860s, the emerging Dominion faced two other types of borders: borders with the Atlantic Ocean and Newfoundland, which was still, of course, a separate colony, and with the Hudson's Bay Company in British territories to the north and west, which at the time, as we can see, included what we now consider northern Ontario and northern Quebec. With British Columbia joining Confederation, the Pacific borders were added to the mix, and each of these border-making processes would require different narratives. In Canada, moreover, there was another boundary-making process that became central to territory: internal boundaries between colonies and later provinces. Here, Confederation mattered a great deal. Though most borders in the East were inherited by the Dominion, the B&A Act empowered the federal government to create new political units and to set their boundaries. In some cases, this power was exercised in absolute and imperial terms, the most famous cases being Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. Manitoba's complicated because MacDonald didn't want to make it a province. He was forced to by Louis Riel and the Métis, but then when he did, he set the borders much smaller than the Métis imagined, and Alberta and Saskatchewan were essentially creations of the federal government in 1905. In this sense, the debate over the hegemony of the federal government through Section 91 seems at some level secondary to other federal powers. To acquire territory, to exploit it, to fill its space, to construct institutions to govern it. This, in fact, was one of the absolutely unique powers of the Dominion in 1867, the ability to create jurisdictions. And it is not, though it was one limited by practical politics, and it is not exactly what we celebrate at July 1st picnics. We'd also have to, although I'm not going to talk about it here, we'd have to consider the role of the sort of border changing over time. So if you set its boundary, the meaning of the border changed. It was largely in the 19th century a customs line. It became a human border in the 20th century, largely under American pressure. And we would have to consider, too, the everyday border, the contrasting experience of slaves and British migrants, or refugees and cross-border shoppers in the 20th century that not only are an everyday experience, but shape the problems that politicians have to deal with. Meyer's argument about territory is only one approach, and it certainly has limitations. But I like it for a couple of reasons. First, it recognizes the importance of the nation as a force in history without assuming it should be the primary container of our knowledge. It puts the nation in play, but also in its place. It makes the nation an important category, but as an empirical, not a transcendent question. Second, Meyer sets up useful questions about the nation-making premises of Canada 150, questions that might lead to Confederation, but also ones that might not. It might also lead, these questions, as many of the papers will argue today, to international, as well as regional, local, religious, energy, and other developments. Confederation becomes an event that should be studied, but not an uber event that everybody needs to study. It didn't make us, after all. There was, in fact, no us to be made in 1867. And over time, identity space has only occasionally been codeterminous with decision space. So, okay, maybe we should talk about Confederation in 2017. But I still wonder about the value of talking about Confederation because of 2017. Even when we do this strategically, we end up with an uber event rather than an event. And while I would admit that Confederation might be more important than, say, Santa Claus or donuts, perhaps this year we could limit ourselves to a baker's dozen of conferences and books instead of mass producing them like so many apple fritters. And with that point, I shall sit down.
You've been listening to a recording of Steve Penfold's talk, Why We Shouldn't Talk About Confederation in 2017. The talk was delivered as part of The Other 60s, the decade that shaped Canada and the world, a symposium hosted by the Department of History at the University of Toronto. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca, and be sure to subscribe to the History Chats podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.